Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is, a free, daily 30-minute program designed to help you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz at the Voice of America's Learning English branch in Washington. It's Monday, November 23rd, 2015. It was on this day in 1992 that the first smartphone was introduced. It was called IBM Simon. You may be listening to this program on your smartphone. Hard to believe the first smartphone was invented almost a quarter century ago. Today on the program, we'll tell you about the tallest monument in the United States. It dominates the skyline of the largest city on the famous Route 66 between Chicago and Los Angeles.
The arch commemorates the 300,000 people who, after Jefferson made the Louisiana Purchase, moved from the eastern part of the country west.
Then, as we always do on Mondays, we will bring you the technology report with Jonathan Evans. This week, Jonathan tells us about a new device that could keep people from suffering from motion sickness.
You imagine being on a bicycle or a motorbike. You go around a corner, you lean into the corner, which remains perfectly upright in physics.
Then, as we do every weekday, we will present The Making of a Nation with Steve Ember. So, you can see, we have a lot for you today. Every day here on As It Is, we bring you news from and about America and the world. And we tell you the often surprising and always interesting history of the United States. We are a little different here at VOA Learning English. Because we exist to help you learn everyday American English, we speak a little slower than normal, and we use words that are easy to understand. Listen to the program, then practice saying the words and sentences the way we do. It's a free and easy way to improve your American English skills every day of the year. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the Voice of America. The tallest monument in the United States dominates the skyline of St. Louis, Missouri, the largest city on Route 66 between Chicago and Los Angeles. The Gateway Arch represents the beginning of the American West. It also commemorates St. Louis's role in the nation's westward expansion. Early settlers in the 1800s depended on the city as a final chance to stock up on food and other provisions before making the long journey west. Katie Weaver, Ashley Thompson, and Jim Tedder tell us more now about the arch and the great westward movement of the 1800s.
The Gateway Arch towers above St. Louis on the banks of the Mississippi River.
The 192-meter-tall stainless steel arch is the tallest structure of its kind in the world. Finnish-American architect Eero Saarinen won a national competition for a design of the proposed monument in 1947. Construction of the Gateway Arch was completed in 1965.
Karen Stieber works at the Jefferson National Expansion Memorial, which includes the Gateway Arch.
The arch commemorates the 300,000 people who, after Jefferson made the Louisiana Purchase, moved from the eastern part of the country west. And this was kind of the meeting place for all of them. This was the last big city where they could provision up before they went west.
The Gateway Arch has an internal tram system. Visitors can ride to the top of the arch for a good view of St. Louis and the Mississippi.
And Eero Saarinen, the architect, made it in the shape of a gate, kind of like you open the gate and step into the new country.
That new country held promise, but it held tragedy, too. The westward expansion of the 1800s brought many Americans to settle on the Great Plains of the United States. Missouri, Oklahoma, and Texas offered good land for farming and raising cows in the early years of settlement.
Then, in the 1930s, disaster struck. A severe and long-lasting drought destroyed crops across the southern Great Plains. Over-farming, or planting too many crops, had destroyed the area's natural grasslands. This left the land unprotected from the windstorms that arrived with the drought. The result was several years of massive, deadly dust storms. The huge area of prairie land in the U.S. became known as the Dust Bowl. The period of time came to be called the Dirty Thirties. Farms, equipment, and homes were sometimes buried in the huge dust storms. At the same time, the U.S. was experiencing a major economic crisis known as the Great Depression.
Mother Nature and the failed economy displaced millions of people who lived in the Dust Bowl. And so began the largest human migration in the United States. Route 66 played a major part in that westward movement of desperately poor people. Hundreds of thousands of people headed west. Many were poor farmers, but teachers, doctors, and other professionals also fled the Dust Bowl. Entire towns disappeared. Whole communities hit the trail. For many, that trail was the newly commissioned Route 66. The highway crossed much of the Dust Bowl into the more fertile land of California. The migrants collected their families and the possessions they could keep. They loaded them into wagons and cars. The trek west continued through the 1930s until the beginning of World War II.
Migrant camps sprung up along Route 66. Most were along narrow man-made waterways used to water crops. This provided the migrants with water for drinking, cooking, and bathing. These poor temporary villages were called ditch bank camps. The writer John Steinbeck traveled Route 66 and visited some of these camps in 1936 and 1937. He reported about them for a newspaper. Steinbeck's news stories were central to the creation of his most famous novel, The Grapes of Wrath. The novel made the road famous and gave it its most popular nickname, the Mother Road.
That book tells the story of the Jodes, a poor migrant family that travels Route 66 from Oklahoma to California during the Dust Bowl period. Today, it is mostly tourists who travel the full distance of Steinbeck's Mother Road. The Dust Bowl and the Depression have long passed. Route 66 is no longer a road of flight, but it remains a powerful symbol of America's westward migration that continues to this day.
That's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from the VOA Learning English headquarters in Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Technology Report. Some people can get motion sickness from being in moving vehicles such as cars or airplanes. But a new device could stop motion sickness by suppressing some signals in the brain. Motion sickness occurs when the motion you sense with your inner ear is different from the motion you see. Symptoms of motion sickness are dizziness, nausea, and vomiting. People have tried different ways to prevent the condition, including wristbands and anti-nausea drugs. But often, nothing works. Now, scientists at Imperial College London are working on a device to counteract motion sickness. Michael Gresty is an expert on the condition.
You imagine being on a bicycle or a motorbike, you go around a corner, you lean into the corner, which remains perfectly upright in physics. You don't do that in a car. You don't do that on a ship. You're actually struggling to find out what is upright and what's the best way of dealing with it.
The device sends a weak electrical current through electrodes placed on a person's head. The electric current appears to cause the brain to suppress signals that affect the inner ear. Researcher Kadir Arshad says the scientist found that it took longer for the individual to develop motion sickness and that they also recovered faster. The next step is to test the device outside the laboratory. Michael Gresty says there are no reports of unwanted side effects from the small amounts of electricity released by the device. The researchers hope a device that plugs into a smartphone and attaches to the head will be available within 10 years. Three university students in Santiago, Chile, have developed a plant-powered device to charge their mobile phones. The three engineering students got the idea for the device while sitting in their school's courtyard. Their invention is a small biological circuit they call IKEA. It captures the energy plants produce during photosynthesis. A plant uses only a small part of the energy produced by that process. The rest goes into the soil. IKEA collects that energy. The device plugs into the ground and then into a mobile phone. The IKEA solved two problems for the engineering students. They needed an idea for a class project. They also needed an outlet to plug in their phones. One of the student inventors, Camila Rupsic, says the device changes the energy released from the plant into low-level power to charge phones. The IKEA is able to fully recharge a mobile phone in less than 2 hours.
And that's the VOA Learning English Technology Report. For more technology stories, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the early weeks of 1863, the American Civil War took a new political direction. President Abraham Lincoln had announced the Emancipation Proclamation. That measure freed the slaves in the rebel states of the South, though Lincoln's words fell on deaf ears. Yet no longer was the Civil War a struggle just to save the Union. It had become a struggle for human freedom. There was a change on the military side of the war, too. President Lincoln named a new commander for the Union's Army of the Potomac. This was the force that would try again to capture the Confederate capital at Richmond, Virginia. This week in our series, Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant describe events during the spring of 1863.
General Joe Hooker was the new commander of the Army of the Potomac. He replaced General Ambrose Burnside when Burnside suffered a terrible defeat at Fredericksburg, Virginia, at the end of 1862. Burnside had replaced General George McClellan when McClellan kept refusing to obey President Lincoln's orders. Hooker had 130,000 men. They were well trained and well supplied. The Confederate force opposing Hooker's was under the command of General Robert E. Lee. Lee had only about 60,000 men. They did not have good equipment, and their supplies were low. But their fighting spirit was high. They had defeated the Union Army before. They were sure they could do it again.
Lee's army still held strong defensive positions along high ground south of Fredericksburg. This was almost halfway between the capitals of the opposing sides, Washington and Richmond. General Hooker did not plan to make the same mistake which General Burnside made at Fredericksburg. Burnside had thrown his army against Lee's defensive positions 6 times. Each time, the Confederates pushed them back easily. In one day of fighting, more than 12,000 Union soldiers were killed or wounded. General Hooker had rebuilt the Army of the Potomac. Now, he was ready to carry out his plan against General Lee. Hooker left half his men at Fredericksburg in front of Lee's army. He would move the other half into position behind Lee's army. If Lee turned to meet him, the troops at Fredericksburg would attack. The Confederate army would be caught between two powerful forces. Lee would have to withdraw or lose his army.
Hooker moved around past the end of Lee's line. Then he turned and started marching back behind it. It was a hard march through thick woods and across rough hills and valleys. The country was so wild that it was called the Wilderness. On the last day of April 1863, the Union force reached Chancellorsville. Chancellorsville was a crossroads near the edge of the Wilderness. The next day, the soldiers would be in open country. There, General Hooker could make the best use of his men. Hooker was extremely pleased. Everything was going as he had planned. He told his officers, "I have Lee in one hand and Richmond in the other." The next day, Union soldiers began moving out of Chancellorsville and the Wilderness. They did not get far. They ran into several thousand Confederate soldiers. Lee had sent them to slow the Union force.
The Confederate force was weak. General Hooker's officers believed they could smash through it without difficulty. They did not get a chance to try. Hooker sent new orders: break off the fight, return to Chancellorsville, put up defensive positions. Hooker's officers were shocked. They protested. Hooker stood firm. He said, "Lee must fight me on my own ground." Robert E. Lee could not understand why the Union force had returned to Chancellorsville, but he was happy it did. Now he had time to prepare his men for battle.
Lee met that night with his top general, Stonewall Jackson. They discussed the best way to attack the Union force. The center of the Union line was strong. The right side was not. Jackson was sure he could get around behind it. Lee asked Jackson how many men he would take. "All of them," Jackson answered, 28,000. This meant Lee would have only 14,000 men to face General Hooker. If the Union force attacked before Stonewall Jackson got into position, Lee could not possibly hold it back. Lee was taking a huge chance. He thought about it for a moment. Then he told Jackson to get started.
Jackson's men began to leave the next morning. Union soldiers watched as they marched away. General Hooker thought Lee was withdrawing. It took Jackson only half a day to get behind the Union force. He spent a few more hours putting his troops into position. Then he attacked. It was 6 o'clock in the evening. The right end of the Union force was not prepared for an attack. The soldiers could not believe their eyes when they saw Confederate troops running out of the woods behind them. Many Union soldiers were killed or wounded. Thousands fled. The sun went down. The fighting continued under a bright moon. The Confederate troops kept moving forward. The Union troops kept falling back. One Northern soldier wrote later, "Darkness was upon us. Jackson was upon us. And fear was upon us."
Jackson seemed to be everywhere. He rode his horse among his men, urging them forward. He would not let the Union force escape. As Jackson and some of his officers rode into a cleared area of the woods, shots rang out. The bullets came from Confederate guns. The Confederate soldiers thought they were firing on Union officers. Jackson fell from his horse. Two bullets had smashed his left arm. Another bullet had hit his right hand. He was hurried to the back of the line. A doctor quickly cut off his left arm and stopped the heavy bleeding. Jackson seemed to get better. Then he developed pneumonia. He was unconscious most of the time. He seemed to dream of battle and shouted commands to his officers. Then he grew quiet. He opened his eyes and said, "Let us pass over the river and rest in the shade of the trees." The great Confederate general Stonewall Jackson was dead.
While Jackson lay dying, the Battle of Chancellorsville continued. Robert E. Lee's Confederate army was much smaller than Joe Hooker's Union army. But for 5 days, Lee kept part of his army moving between Chancellorsville and Fredericksburg. Wherever the Union army attacked, Lee quickly added more men to his lines. The Union army could not break through. The fighting was taking place on the south side of the Rappahannock River. The Union Army's supply lines were on the north side. Spring rains were beginning to make the Rappahannock rise. General Hooker did not want to get trapped without food and ammunition, so he ordered his men back across the river.
The South had won the Battle of Chancellorsville. Robert E. Lee was sure of that. Once again, he had forced back the Army of the Potomac. But the Union Army was not hurt seriously. New soldiers would soon take the place of those lost in battle. Lee, however, would find it more difficult to replace his soldiers. The South was running out of manpower. Every Confederate army needed men, more and more men. Yet fewer and fewer Southern boys were willing to become soldiers. Anti-war movements were, in fact, active in both the North and South. There were a number of protests against the military draft. Some turned violent. In the North, a political party was created to oppose the Civil War. Leaders of this peace party were called Copperheads. They got the name because they wore a copper penny showing the head of an Indian. That will be our story in our next program on the Civil War.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant. Our series can be found online with transcripts, podcasts, and historical images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow our weekly programs on Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.